Hey, wie schön, dass du hier heute wieder am Start bist bei den Mindful Sessions, bei deinem Podcast für mehr Achtsamkeit und Soul Power. Mein Name ist Sarah Desai und dich erwartet hier heute ein ganz besonderes Interview mit einem ganz besonderen Gast, nämlich mit Lama Rod Owens. Lama Rod Owens ist einer der spirituellen Lehrer unserer Zeit. Und wir sprechen heute unter anderem darüber, wie wir unser gebrochenes Herz heilen können. Als einzelner Mensch, aber eben auch als Kollektiv, als Gesellschaft. Wie können wir gesellschaftliche Traumata aufarbeiten? Denn wir befinden uns gerade in einer Zeit, in der ganz viel Umbruch stattfindet, in der wir merken, hey, so können wir nicht weitermachen. Und genau in dieser Zeit können wir umdenken, können wir umfühlen, können wir einander verstehen lernen und können vor allem einander heilen, alte Trauma heilen, um neue Wege zu beschreiten für uns alle. Ich wünsche dir ganz viel Freude mit dieser Podcast-Folge und Lama Rod Owens teilt eben nicht nur Theorien mit uns, sondern gibt auch in dieser Folge ganz viele Praxistipps für deine spirituelle Praxis. Also ganz viel Input erwartet dich hier. Und ja, ich würde sagen, let's go. I want to say a very, very warm welcome to a special guest. I was looking forward to this interview for a very long time. Lama Rod Owens, you are like a leader of the next generation of Dharma teachers. You completed the 3 years silent retreat and I really love the way you are teaching and I love the way you share your vulnerability and a very warm welcome. Hi.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I was reading your book in English and now also in German because as we release the podcast, your book is also available in German. In English, it's called Rage and Love. And in German, it's called Liebe und Wut. And it's about rage and love. And I would like to talk about rage. And there is one quote in the book that really got me from Maya Sati Bhagavati. Mm-hmm. It is easy for a spiritual teacher to say, give up anger. But there is reason for anger if we look at the plight of the world's children. And I just don't mean babies. I mean all of Earth's children who are caught in war, hunger, disease, injustice. Sometimes it looks like there is no justice anywhere in the world. And I think everyone listening to the podcast knows this feeling. And I love this quote because it prevents us of spiritual bypassing.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little more about how can we transform rage, but without getting blind for all the suffering which is in the world?
Yeah, you know, I think that all of this is so complex. You know, as Majaya pointed out in the quote you just shared, it's like, how do you look at everything that's happening in the world right now and not just feel overwhelmed by the injustice? Right. And I think this is one of like the most asked questions in any spiritual path is why is there so much suffering? Right. And I think that when we don't understand that, like there's just a lot of anger, there's a lot of rage. Right. But the work that I've been doing in my own practice, right, and it also in my teaching has really helped me to understand that, like, it's not that I'm angry, it's that I'm hurt. I'm in pain. My heart is just really broken. I'm not pissed off because of injustice. I am sad. I'm disappointed, you know, because there's so much suffering for everyone else in the world, including for myself. And I have to actually go back into this sadness, this disappointment, this heartbrokenness in order to understand how to skillfully work in the world and be in the world right now. You know, our anger is really important. Like my anger tells me that something's wrong, right? There's something really wrong, but it's my brokenheartedness that actually tells me how to decrease suffering, how to decrease violence and harm, how to work towards that. My anger doesn't do that, right? It's through the brokenheartedness that I begin to understand that everyone else is brokenhearted, especially the people who I believe are creating injustice, doing harm, doing violence, right? You know, they're hurting as much as I am, right? And they're making certain decisions, you know, about that hurt that maybe is creating a lot more harm and suffering for the rest of us.
So they are like not looking at their pain, yeah, making the decision to push the pain, yeah, away, like go over the pain and create more pain.
Yeah.
So is it like you say, if I'm hurting someone, mm-hmm, I also always hurt myself. I, yes, hurt the environment, I hurt the people, mm-hmm, but I also hurt myself. And this is something very deeply rooted, and I have to look at my own brokenheartedness to actually stop hurting other people?
Yeah, I think that some of the most violent people in the world are some of the most brokenhearted people as well. And because they are not in relationship to their brokenheartedness or are trying to do something about their brokenheartedness, they're just reacting to the pain and they're reacting to the anger, mm-hmm, you know, from the pain and just creating more suffering. Because it's a bypass, right? It just bypasses all the discomfort. You know, it takes us out of our bodies. It takes us out of our emotions into this disembodied place where we can just do whatever we want, right? And when we're disembodied, it's easier to see not just our bodies as objects, but also other people as objects. You know, objects with no agency, no emotion, no feeling. You know,
and how would you say can I hold people accountable, mm-hmm, for what they are doing in the world, mm-hmm, but still create like an open space for them and for their brokenheartedness? You know, if I like in personal matters, like if I have conflict with my family, right, maybe this is already like difficult, but, mm-hmm, this is like, I guess, easier than when we talk about social injustice,
yes,
you know, like suffering from so many people who were like systematically oppressed. How is your practice in that? Because I mean, as a Black queer person,
yeah, mm-hmm,
you know pain and, yeah, you know anger and you know suffering. So, and how can you heal yourself and still hold the space for people who actually harmed you systematically?
Yes. Well, you know, for me, it comes back to the practice of love and compassion. Love and compassion begins with myself. Right. So essentially, love and compassion together means that I am experiencing my brokenheartedness. I know what it feels like. And I begin to reflect on how others around me are also experiencing brokenheartedness. And I don't want to be in suffering. And I'm sure others don't want to be in suffering. So therefore, I commit to helping alleviate suffering for all of us. And I do that through always remembering that people are in pain, even the people who hurt me, right? And so when I am in, a personal situation with someone who's creating harm for me, first and foremost, I say, we're hurting. Right? Both of us are hurting. And I want you to hurt less. And so therefore, I have to actually mirror back to you the harm that you're creating for me and for yourself. And that mirroring means that I set boundaries, right? I try to disrupt that harm as much as possible while staying in contact with your experience of brokenheartedness. Because if I disconnect from the brokenheartedness, then I become retaliatory, or I try to retaliate against you, right? I will start wanting you to hurt as much as I do. And that's not my goal. That's not my intention anymore in the world, is to make people hurt as much as I do. My intention is to reduce harm and violence. And the only way I can do that in relationships with people who harm me is just by reflecting back, setting boundaries, letting people know how they're hurting me, right? And helping them to get that, to get how they're hurting me. And if they don't get that, then I have to refrain from the relationship somehow.
And you talk about in the book about loving our anger. It's not about pushing it away or turning it into happiness. It's anger is anger, and it's not like a beautiful feeling. It makes us feel a certain way. And you say, I'm not saying that I love what it does or how it makes me feel. But I love my anger because it's mine. And loving my anger means like loving myself, accepting me, accepting my feeling, accepting my story. And when I read this or when I read this, I really ask myself, okay, how can I embody my anger? How can I actually get in contact with my anger? Because we know this word anger and rage, but how does it feel? What, why am I angry? And can I say, like, not say I am angry, but I feel angry?
Right.
Can you like talk or share some points like on how to really like connect with my anger? Because I think we've learned like anger is something bad and you shouldn't be angry because then you are like complicated or you're too much or you're too loud or you should just be happy. Yeah, but these are all concepts, which are obviously not working. So how in the first place can I get in contact with this feeling, with this part of me?
Well, I think that you point out something really important is that we're all struggling with these cultural narratives about how we should be in relationship to our anger. Many of us grow up being told different messages about how we should or should not experience anger. Often with my, female identified friends, they grow up, being told that, well, girls don't get angry, or good girls don't get angry, right? Part of the message that I got was that it was fine for me as a boy, right? To be angry. Like it was just like acceptable, much more than it was for girls when I was growing up. Right. So there are all these like narratives, but once we get older, like we have to actually take the step to actually understand that we have never really experienced our anger. We've talked about our anger, we've reacted to our anger, but we've never really experienced the energy of anger. And for me, that was the most important practice. Was actually learning how to experience anger, not react to it, not think about it, but experience it. And when I started practicing that, I began to understand that like anger lived in my body. Like anger was a sensation that was in my body, first and foremost, right? And then my mind labeled that sensation as anger. And when I started really experiencing anger, I developed this very intense agency where I just wasn't reacting to anger anymore. I was experiencing anger. And when I was able to experience anger, I could respond to the anger, right? But also when I stopped reacting to the anger, I could get to the brokenheartedness beneath the anger. You know, and that was transformative because I realized that every time that I was saying, oh, I'm pissed off about this, I'm pissed off about that, I was pissed off, but actually the real experience was that I was hurt. And I started saying that. Instead of saying pissed off, I was like, I would just start saying, I'm hurt by this. I'm hurt by this thing that I'm seeing and experiencing in the world. And that opened my heart. That's a heart-opening experience when I touch the brokenheartedness, right? And then when I go back to the anger becomes this experience that is actually trying to take care of me, because my anger is actually, one, trying to show me that something's wrong, and secondly, it's trying to point me back to the brokenheartedness, because the brokenheartedness is the primary emotion and anger is the secondary emotion. There's no anger without a primary emotion, which is usually hurt, right? And so when we start that process, it changes, right? And then I start responding. Like, I can choose how to respond. You know, if I'm in a situation where, you know, I've been hurt and I feel the anger arising, then I have the space to respond now that says, okay, what's the best thing to do right now to limit harm? You know, whereas before this practice, I would just react to the anger and do something unskillful, like engage in violence or say something or do something else that escalated, you know, the violence in the situation. Now I can step back and say, you know what, I'm going to choose a better way to disarm the situation.
What would you say is, like, in your personal case, the better way or the other way to, like, deal with the anger or the brokenheartedness, instead of choosing to interact in a form of violence, what is your practice now? Because I think a lot of people have the impression that, like, if we are teaching spirituality or meditation, that is against or is the opposite from activism, but it's
right.
So that's why I would like to hear from you, because I know you're an activist also. How you combine these?
Well, I think first and foremost, I communicate, right? I communicate what I'm feeling, right? If I'm having a conflict with someone that can potentially escalate into something much bigger, I try to just, like, kind of pause and have this space where I'm just like, this is what I'm experiencing. This is what I'm struggling with in this moment, right? I'm trying not to react to the anger. I just want you to understand, like, what my experience is. And I want to be open to what someone else's experience is also in the moment, right? But there's also this area where sometimes the only way to de-escalate a conflict is to meet the energy of that conflict, right? Which means that sometimes if someone's coming to me with a lot of, like, violence and a lot of intense energy, sometimes I have to meet that energy. You know, if someone's yelling at me, sometimes I have to yell back. I'm not yelling because, you know, I want them to hurt. I'm yelling because that's the only way that they will hear me, you know? Sometimes if there's a physical thing happening, you know, I have to meet physical harm with my own physical reaction. Like, I want to protect myself, Right? I'm not protecting myself because I want the other person to hurt. I'm protecting myself because I love myself, right? And this person is out of control. So I'm not only protecting myself, I'm trying to limit the harm that they're doing for themselves as well, right? It's just a reframing. Like that reframing, really, it's a kind of accountability, you know, that we can really train in. It takes a while. You know, it's taken me years and years to get to this point. But when I choose to respond in what would seem like a violent way, I'm choosing that because that's the only way to disrupt the escalation of violence. You know, not the other way, not the other way where it's like, I just want to whoop someone's ass because I'm pissed off. I'm not into that anymore. But this is about training in an ethic of reducing violence. It's not that I'm not necessarily nonviolent. No one can be 100% nonviolent because we're always impacting other people around us in ways that we're not even conscious of that may be really hurtful. That's hard. But I am trying to be conscious about how I respond to my experiences and the impact that response has on others around me. Mm-hmm. With the goal of always doing what I feel can reduce the violence.
Mm-hmm. Thank you mm-hmm. for sharing this. And and another question is from me, when you started like working with your anger, right? In your book, you wrote that in your teachings, people came to you and said, hey, you should look at your anger. And like how, because you also write it in the book, it's not like, it's not a beautiful thing. It's like a love song, but it's not, this like totally romantic love song. It's like you have the love and you have the anger and you have to love your anger, but it's not this, okay, I just decide to love my anger and then everything's just beautiful. So how would you recommend people who, because there's a lot of anger in this world, let's be honest. So yeah everyone individual for themselves, but as a collective also. What is the first thing you would say can help us to interact with our anger, so at the end maybe it turns out to this, like as you described, love song, and maybe not to have this this view of, okay, there's a goal and the goal is everything has to be shiny when mm-hmm. I interact with my anger. Mm-hmm. So just to really take it as it is and mm-hmm. to get in contact with it before having this idea of, okay, there's this shiny gold at the end of the tunnel when mm-hmm. I interact with my anger.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is really about developing realistic goals in our practice. So we talk about, you know, developing a practice around our anger. Well, this is going to take a while to do. And I think that we're too results oriented. You know, and anger is one of the strongest energies that moves through our experience. So like, this is going to be a tough journey, a tough ride, right? Again, you know, there's so much anger in the world because there's so much hurt, you know, and we're not taking care of the hurt. We're just reacting to the anger, right? And so I think often the practice is acknowledging, yes, there is anger in my experience, and anger is an experience. Like, and that's like a mantra that we can just start saying and telling ourselves, this is just an experience. This is not who I am. Like, instead of saying, oh, I'm pissed off, I'm angry, I'm enraged, say this, I am experiencing rage. I'm experiencing frustration. I am experiencing anger. Right. And that's going to start allowing more space to open up Right. And when that space opens up, we can get to the hurt. And that's the hurt is what drives the anger. You know, it's like, you know, it's like a fire. You know, we may build a fire, you know, and maybe initially there's a lot of smoke in the fire, you know. And that's how I understand beginning a practice with anger. There's going to be a lot of smoke. You're not going to get to the heat. And that heat is just like the fruition, the result of practice. You're just going to have to deal with a lot of smoke until you get that fire really going, right? And it's patience. You know, often in Buddhism, patience is the antidote to anger, which I never really talk about because patience has never been a strong practice for me in terms of anger. Like, I wanted something deeper and more direct, right? And just starting with, this is just an experience over and over again, right? You know, and so many of us are habitually reacting to the anger. So we don't even know that we're reacting until much later. But it's important that we start developing this intention to wake up as soon as possible. And what I mean by waking up is that I want to notice as soon as possible when I have been reacting to anger. And that may be like well after a situation has arisen that I've reacted to. But whenever that happens, I wake up and say, oh, okay, I really reacted to that, you know, in a really harmful way. I'm going to do better next time. And the more you do that, the more you get closer and closer and closer to that moment of reactivity. And when you get to that moment of reactivity, you make a different choice and say, you know what, am I going to react to what's arising? I'm just going to feel it. I'm going to experience it. You know, it doesn't mean that you lose a kind of connection to what's happening in the moment. You know, it means that you actually get clearer about what's happening in the moment instead of just reacting
to what's happening. So your views are not blurry from the anger.
Yeah, yeah.
See clearer. And what I experience a lot is like that me and other people, I think we are scared of maybe what is underneath the anger. Mm-hmm. We are scared of our brokenheartedness, yeah, because we are conditioned like a lifetime and even mm-hmm. maybe more lifetimes before to protect our heart, right? To like from our parents, we already learned, put yourself together and don't cry, maybe. Yeah. So it's like, man, you have to be tough. And I think in every childhood, there were moments where we felt brokenheartedness, the first moments we felt brokenheartedness, and we felt alone and we felt like, okay, I have to pull myself together. And so some of these patterns run very, very, very deep in us, right? So I think anger maybe is for us like, okay, I'm enraged and this is something like very active and like maybe, yeah, something harmful, but we associate maybe something strong with it. While brokenheartedness is like, mm-hmm. of course, when I really go into the practice, it's yeah. like really, really strong. But in the, yeah. like what we are like conditioned, you know, it's for us like something we just have to open. It's not this, okay, I'm marching and, you know, doing something. It's like, okay, I have to sit with it and I have to open up. And I think a lot of us are scared to go to that source because we've never learned it, right? We've learned from the beginning to protect our hearts. Of course, that doesn't work. That's why we are in all or a lot of mess. So in your own experience, how did you start to interact with your brokenheartedness? Is it like in small doses or is it sometimes, like for me, sometimes it's just overwhelming and yeah. it's always, I mean, this moments where I really like break down are the most like that give me freedom in the long run. But it's work, and it takes in the first place, it's not empowering. Of course, on the long run, it's empowering, totally. But how did you start, and yeah, how did you dance with your brokenheartedness?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think what I had to learn was to embrace the practice of grief and mourning, right? And grief is connecting. When I grieve, I'm connecting to the energy of brokenheartedness. And when I mourn, I kind of perform that energy. I release that energy in mourning, you know? But I had to just start understanding how grieving is just really has to be a basic practice that I do every day, that I have to grieve everything. I have to experience the brokenheartedness. And to understand that the brokenheartedness isn't bigger than who I am. Like it's, you know, in Buddhism, we talk about the mind. The grief is just, and the brokenheartedness is just an expression of the mind itself. You know, the brokenheartedness, just like if we use the analogy of an ocean, if the ocean is like a mind, then the brokenheartedness are just waves rising and falling from the ocean of the mind. And I had to really start training in that to always understand that, like, whatever I am experiencing is just an expression of the nature of my mind. And my mind is vast, boundless, pure. You know, my mind is, the essence of my mind is joy, you know, and energy, you know, and not the grief, not the anger, right? And that gave me a lot of agency in terms of my grief, right? And to connect that to the practice of mourning, like, what, how do we channel this energy? You know, like, you know, we cry, we have rituals and ceremonies that allow, and that's what we need, not just the experiencing of the brokenheartedness, but a way to channel the energy of the brokenheartedness, you know, to get that energy moving around, you know, and for a lot of people, movement is a part of that grief, and movement is a big practice. That's a practice for me. I do all kinds of ceremonies to work with my brokenheartedness. You know, and that's what we need. Like, we need to connect to rituals and ceremonies to channel the energy. You know, the brokenheartedness seems overwhelming because that energy is just sitting there, you know, but starting to channel that energy in mourning is actually really important for all of us to do, and to do it with others, to do it collectively is really important. Like, collective mourning and really collective group practice in general is actually quite powerful, you know, because we begin to help each other, you know, in the practice, no matter what the practice is, you know. But again, it's, you know, for me, I just had to just say that, like, grief and mourning is just my daily practice now. And I don't feel overwhelmed by that. It's just, you know, when I feel the brokenheartedness and the grief coming up, I just allow it to arise. And then I know how to channel it. Like, I do something, you know, be it movement, be it another ritual, be it meditation, whatever it may be. I let this energy move through me. And that way I don't feel overwhelmed.
I totally get it. So it's yeah, I think we label scared with brokenheartedness, but the moment we experience it and like allow it to be there and work with it and interact with it and like engage in this certain kind of dance with it, however this would like look like, is it's we are losing this label. Okay, we have to it's negative. We have to be scared of it. It's a part of us which we can like in any other part of us like interact with. You also wrote in your book about ancestors, and I had a very, for myself personally, like 15 years ago, a session with my ancestors, interacting with my ancestors was like the starting point for everything for me. Because I personally, I know very little like about my family lineage. So I always had this issue. Okay, I feel kind of not rooted. Who am I? Who are my people? And in this session with my ancestors, that was just so powerful for me, you know, to feel all these people on my back. And as a child growing up here in like Germany, after this experience, I started to intellectualize. And I was like, yeah, but is that they can't be my ancestors because I don't know my ancestors. Right. And it took a while for me to understand that my ancestors don't have to be like from my family lineage. They can be my spiritual ancestors. They can like be ancestors who maybe experience the same things as me, and just to feel this collective. You know, this to be whole or to be guided, maybe or especially in our spiritual work. And so I loved reading about the ancestors in your book, and especially with the brokenheartedness and the grief. Can you give like the listeners maybe a practice how to interact with our ancestors, how to get in touch with our ancestors, and maybe even if it's only like, you know, being like, hey, I need help, I need guidance, this how do we interact, or how do you teach interacting? I know it's limited here on the podcast, but maybe you can give us some insights.
You know, everything you just shared is really how I was introduced to ancestors, you know, and it was through friends who were connected to their ancestors. And I think my ancestors were communicating through them to communicate to me, you know, and so that's what really started my ancestor practice, you know. And first and foremost, it was just like acknowledging that I am surrounded by beings who are trying to take care of me. Like, that was the first practice, right? It's just opening to that idea, you know? And then beyond that, I just started experimenting and like just reaching out and asking for help, you know? I remember one year, a couple of years ago, I was in Paris and had to meet a friend of mine, and I was kind of lost and my phone wasn't really working well. You know, and like my French is like limited, you know? So like, I was just like, oh, I'm lost. And then I just had this idea, and the idea was like, I'm just gonna ask my ancestors to like guide me somewhere, you know? And I did it, and I just like felt guided. Like that's the best way to describe it. I just felt like there was someone guiding me in the direction. And I eventually was able to like, you know, kind of wander around and like find the place that I was meeting my friend, you know? And I think we just have to do things like that. It's just experiment, just like ask for help and then see how that help is offered. And of course that help can come in dreams, visions, intuitions, impressions, feelings. You know, another really great thing is to set up a space in our home. It doesn't have to be a huge space where we can like create an ancestor altar. Like if you really want to like intensify this connection, create a space where, you know, these beings can focus, you know, their connection to us, right? And altars do that. And it doesn't have to be a complicated thing. Sometimes it's just a candle, you know, something, but something dedicated, you know, it's kind of a home base for ancestors in our personal space. And that has been really important for me in deepening my connection as well. And you're absolutely right, you know, to say that, like, our ancestors aren't necessarily our families. You know, they're spiritual ancestors. You know, if we identify as queer, it's our queer ancestors. You know, for artists, it's like, you know, the lineage of artists that inspired us. Like, and this is what I teach in a practice called the Seven Homecomings, where I just kind of get people to open up to all the ways in which there are these beings who have chosen to help us, right? And how they're around us and how we can actually intensify that help by acknowledging their presence and learning how to communicate with them, you know. And you don't have to, again, know who these beings are. They know who you are. Like, that's the point. They know who you are because they've chosen to be with you, which I think is extraordinary.
I think this is so empowering because, like, as humans, we long for togetherness, right? This mm-hmm. is what we long for. And we often feel so overwhelmed and feel alone. And I think that's our biggest fear, to be neglected and to be alone and to not know what to do. And just to have this knowing, not only this feeling, this knowing, I'm not alone and I'm guided. Yeah. This is so powerful. I had a practice a few weeks ago, and then the teacher said, you know, when you really feel lost, just raise your hand and say, he said father, but he didn't mean the one father. Father, I need help, please help me. Or mother, I need help, please help me. Doesn't have to be your mother or father, right? Have gave birth to you, but just this gesture it's so empowering.
Yes, it is. You know, just open, mm-hmm. just open. Like that's so much. You know, I know that people are often afraid because they don't know who they're calling. And because there are like negative energies mm-hmm. also around us as well. And so ancestor practice isn't like this perfect practice that we're always going to be taking care of. There are ancestors who are actually trying to hurt us as well. It's not, and again, it's just like what we were talking about earlier. It's not that these beings are malicious. It's that they're hurting themselves, right? You know, and they're reacting to their hurt in the same way they reacted to their hurt in the living worlds, you know, in their lives. And we have to, you know, just know that we can create barriers, you know. So in my practice, I'm always very intentional about saying that I'm only interested in helpful, benevolent beings being around me, you know. And you can say that. I think that's important to say, you know, because especially if you're anxious about this, just set up those boundaries and say, I can only work with beings, you know, who are here to help. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are ancestors who need help, who aren't malicious. They're not trying to hurt you, but they just need support and help. Sometimes we can't offer that help. It depends on where we are in our practice, right? So we can also be clear about that like, I'm not in a position to help right now. For those of you who need help, I'm only opening to beings who can offer help and support. And then over time, you learn how to offer support back to ancestors and beings.
And actually, we can translate that to not only our ancestors, mm-hmm. like to everyone, because we are, like we said in the beginning, living in a world with a lot of anger or brokenheartedness or frustration. And I think we all come in situations like where we step into a room and there is this energy because maybe someone had a fight with someone else, right? And we don't have to be highly sensitive person or people to catch this vibe in the room. And also there, I think it's very like important for me to stay in my energy, to not like catch the frustration from other people, although I can sense it, but at the same time, not shut down. So like my emotional barriers or boundaries, but still not to lock myself up. And I think this is also a practice because, man, every day this will happen to us. The only thing to avoid it is to lock myself in my home or to lock myself, like to lock my heart, right? So also to how do I interact with the world and with other human beings and still stay in my own energy.
Absolutely. It's about just like understanding that we have a right to have space around us to move through the world. You know, it's, you know, I do, in the past, I've done a little bit of Aikido practice as a martial arts. And, you know, I don't know about other forms of martial arts, but in Aikido, what you're taught is that you have this personal space that you're trying to maintain and protect. Like you're not trying to collapse that space, right? But you should always have this space that you're moving in to protect yourself, to do everything that you need to do. And I think that's important for us to bring into our daily practice, is that I have this space that I want to maintain, right? You know, and that space is supported by boundaries and being clear about what I need and what others need. You know, and I think it's hard right now for that, you know, because many of us need a lot of support. Like we need a lot of things. Also, we don't even know what we need on top of that, right? You know, that's what happens when you're so overwhelmed by everything. It's like, where do you begin? And again, I begin with the basics. Like I begin with rest and food and water, right? And shelter and clothing and medical care. Like that's the base care for me. And then I start asking more, okay, what else do I need? You know, again, my self-care is about making sure that I feel resourced enough to help others and to be functional in the world and to do the work that is meaningful for me. It's not self-indulgence. You know, everything that I do, no matter how frivolous it seems, is really about making sure that I feel well enough to be of help for others.
I love the picture with we all need our space, and we have the right to own the space in which we navigate through the world. It's a beautiful picture. And I think, like, especially now, and you also write about it in your book, I think you call it even apocalypse now.
Yes.
It's a time where we feel that a lot of things are disrupting. And you said that a lot of people come to you and ask you, hey, what's going on?
Yeah.
What's going on in the world? And you refer to, like, Christian theology, they call it apocalypse, then in Hindu tantric tradition, Kali Yuga, and in Buddhism, the Dark Ages, and that now something, we come to a point where like things that we tried to cover up for so many years, we can't cover it up anymore. And I think there's a beautiful chance in there, right, for collective transformation and collective healing, but also a lot of work. If we look at social issues, the way like people were oppressed, or like even also environmental issues, like, you know, everywhere we see that the world as we knew it before, doesn't matter if we suffered from it or if we took advantage of certain aspects, it doesn't work like it anymore. And we have to look, and that's what I'm trying to look at, also my part, which is not beautiful, because I know where I suffered, and that's much more easy for me to say where I suffered because I was harmed. But to say, this is also my, let's say, guilt, or this is something I feel ashamed of, because, you know, no one wants to be the person who harmed someone, or, you know, to really own this part of shame also, and to say, hey, but we need to do it, because otherwise everything's gonna maybe collapse, you know. Right. We can't cover it up anymore as an individual and as a collective. So I loved reading that, and maybe you can tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, this is, you know, a period of unveiling truth, like truth telling, right? And unfortunately, you know, many of us spend so much of our lives lying to ourselves, you know, lying about ourselves, lying about the world around us, because that's the way that we survive, you know, because maybe we don't have the capacity to really like take in the truth, right? And that's why periods like this is so intense, because ready or not, like the truth is here. And what many of us have to do is really hurry up and develop a capacity to hold the truth. And holding the truth really means doing emotional labor of experiencing the disappointment and the frustration and the anger and the grief and the sadness and the isolation, everything that's arising for us. You know, to offer all of that immense amounts of space, you know, and that's all we're being called to do. And that's called metabolizing, you know. I think we're doing, well, I think we could be far worse off than we are at this point in this apocalypse. Like, I think there are enough of us who are able to do a lot of work for the collective that's keeping the collective from completely spinning off track, right? But it doesn't mean that like there's not more to come, and that we won't get deeper into a lot of stuff that will be quite challenging, you know? But I believe that we will make it through this, that we are being changed, that there are so many people who are beginning to wake up and understand, you know, what their roles are in this life and in this world. And they're making choices to do better, you know, and to understand more, right? And there are people who won't do that. There are people who won't step up in a way to doing this really important labor. And this is why I say that there's going to be a lot of people who won't make it. Like, it doesn't mean that they're going to die. It doesn't mean any of that. It means that, like, they just won't be able to hold all of this, you know, and push through, you know. It doesn't mean that they're lost or they're gone, because I believe in, you know, that we're just in this huge continuum, life after life, where we're just doing work, and we're all at different points in this continuum, you know. And it's fine. I think there's going to be new issues for us in the coming years, you know, in terms of how do you relate to people who are just like functioning from a very different space now, who didn't actually push through this evolution into a new way of being. How are we going to relate to communities like that? And so people, and these people are like people close to us as well. You know, so it's not like these people are over there. They're here. They're our loved ones. They're our friends and so forth.
Thank you. I hear that a lot. Sorry for interrupting.
Yeah, no.
From people I'm working with, a lot of times when people start their own practice and, you know, they start interacting from a different kind of place, they say, but what do I do with the people in my environment? For example, my family, what do I do if my family has another opinion and they don't interact with themselves and they are not working with themselves? And so this is a very common question for people who start working with themselves and engaging with their feelings and engaging in in order to heal for themselves, but also as a collective, that the first question that arises is, okay, I'm now in my practice and I feel good, or I feel this is my path. But at the moment I meet, for example, my father or my sister, then I get these pushbacks. How do I interact with that? It's a very, very common question, I think.
Yeah, and again, like the root practice or the best practice is compassion. It's like just relating and saying, yeah, you know, I get it, you know. And then we have to make other choices about how we're going to be in a relationship now. Like, and or can we be in relationship? You know, those are the hard questions for us. But when you make a choice to evolve through practice, then you have to work really hard to maintain relationships where people maybe aren't doing the same practices or have the same commitments as you do. And I've gone through that. I've been through that. I've been pretty successful because of compassion, you know, really understanding that, like, you know, understanding why I'm in a relationship with folks and really understanding, trying to figure out other ways that we can experience commonality and belonging that maybe isn't about, you know, the stuff that I'm getting into and experiences that I'm having. And that's been really useful.
And I bet you still have a great impact on them in another way, because you interact in another way. And I think this is so important, because of course I can choose who I want to interact with and also set my boundaries, but not everyone has to be on my path in order to interact, and we can still like have something beautiful and profit from each other in a beautiful way. Not talking about teachings or things like that, but still there is something growing, something different, a different flower, but it's still growing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much. The book is out. Love and Rage, Wut und Liebe. And I heard you are also offering a retreat.
Yes, we're going to be doing a one-day online retreat. And that information is online. And they can go to my website and also, you know, sign up for my newsletter as well. You'll get all that information.
We put all the links in the show notes to the book, to your website, to the retreat. And thank you so, 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 so much for your time. I was so looking forward to this interview and to this conversation. Thank you for all that you are doing. Really, you inspire me since a long time, and I just have to say thank you to you. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Vielen Dank auch an dich, dass du heute wieder zugehört hast. Ich wünsche dir jetzt noch einen wunderschönen Tagabend, wo auch immer du gerade